You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Troy Oppie in for Gemma Gaudette. It's Friday. You made it. And it's time for our reporter roundtable. That's when we get you up to date on all the news that made headlines this past week. Today, our panel includes Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, James Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Aaron Bamer, the Nampa Caldwell reporter for the Idaho Press. Hey, everyone. Happy Friday.
Hey, Troy.
Happy Friday.
Happy Friday.
All right. Happy Friday indeed. So the spread of COVID-19 has leveled off, we can say, I think, but it does not show any signs of slowing down. The state's averaging right around 3,500 new confirmed cases per week since July 4th. 138 people have now died from the virus, 38 in the last 14 days. And on Monday this week, the state reported its highest single-day death toll with 6 fatalities. The majority of all this spread is in the Treasure Valley. Aaron, let's start with you in Canyon County. We heard during George's newscast the audio from that meeting yesterday, the applause saying there would be no face masks required at that meeting. A meeting that was on again, off again for 2 weeks due to safety concerns. And in the end, they basically punted the most controversial issue off the agenda entirely, didn't they?
Yeah, you summarized that really well. It's been a very crazy week, I think, for Southwest District Health particularly. I have to give credit to our Canyon County Public Safety reporter, Olivia Hirsink. She's been covering this story really well. Mm-hmm. So there were a series of 3 meetings by Southwest District Health, the board trying to meet to discuss possible measures to ensure the safety in Canyon County. The first meeting was last week and was primarily held virtually, but had to stop about 30 minutes in because a group of people were trying to force their way in without masks. The public were allowed within the building, but they had to wear masks to get in. But this group of people did not want to and wanted to attend the meeting to kind of voice their opinions against possible mask mandates. The Southwest District Health eventually canceled that meeting and postponed it to this week, which was then canceled again a second time due to security concerns, and was finally held yesterday at the Canyon County Courthouse. About 100 members of the public attended and crowded into a courtroom, and most were not wearing masks. But the board eventually did pass some recommendations to wear masks, depending on how severe the outbreak was in the area. And despite the fact that most of the people that were there were speaking out against mask mandates, they still booed after they passed the recommendations. There was some conflict between members of the public, it seemed, and health officials who were attending the meeting virtually, some of which noted that they were disappointed that the board officials did not pass any stricter measures and just settled for recommendations.
Melissa Davlin, you've watched many of these local health districts meetings over the last week or so. You were live tweeting the Panhandle meeting yesterday afternoon, and that one sounded contentious, similarly to what Aaron just described in the Southwest District. These are independent entities. They're not beholden to state health and welfare. They're not beholden to the governor's office. But there seems to be a pretty clear line drawn at these meetings between public officials, county commissioners, members of the public who are either showing up in person or trying to get in to show up in person, and the health officials that are part of these. What are you seeing across the state?
This dynamic has been so interesting, and it's really been different region to region. So, of course, there are 7 different health districts in Idaho. Over the last week, I've sat in on meetings for 6 of the 7. The only reason I didn't hit that 7th was because it was at the same time as that Panhandle meeting. And it really varies based on where they are in the state, how closely they listen to not just the medical professionals on their board of health, but also their local hospital officials. The Panhandle Health District, for example, yesterday had Kootenai Health CEO come in and talk about how concerned they are about their hospital capacity, They said that they had had 4 deaths at Kootenai Health so far. Not all of those have been reported to the state yet, by the way. So we are going to see those numbers go up soon. And regardless of what they're hearing from health professionals, you still had 2 board members who were spreading misinformation about masks and test positivity and everything. There's one anecdote that I keep hearing pop up again and again. I've heard it multiple times in the last week, and it's that goats have tested positive for COVID-19 and fruit goats. Has tested positive. Yeah, goats,
yeah,
the animal.
The papayas.
And papayas. So I looked this up. I was like, okay, I've heard it enough. It originated from the president of Tunisia. Tunisia is not known for its transparency when it comes to its COVID-19 response or really any government related issues. And he claimed back in, I think, May, that we couldn't trust their high numbers of COVID-19 because, well, you know, we're seeing goats test positive and papaya test positive and all this stuff. So you have, I just want to make this clear. You have these Board of Health officials who are trusting social media rumors out of Tunisia more than they're trusting their own public health officials in their community, more than they're trusting their own CDC. And it's wild, man. It is a post-truth discussion. Now, regardless of that, the Panhandle Health District still voted to mandate masks in Kootenai County, which is seeing an exponential rise in cases. They have 1,200 known cases right now, most of which have been recorded in the month of July, 300 just this week, and we're going to see more as we move forward.
And as you noted yesterday while live tweeting that meeting, they were summarily booed when they passed that mandate, right?
They were. There were a couple of outbursts, one when public testimony ended, and then after they voted 4-2 for the mandate. It was rowdy enough that they had to shut down the live stream and take care of the protesters. I, of course, wasn't there, but I saw reports on social media that there were people crying in the hallway and screaming that the law enforcement had to get involved to calm people down and escort some people out. I saw at least one woman being escorted out on camera. And so it was something. It was really, really something. You compare that to some of these other health districts that have been very calm. Eastern Idaho Health District, Public Health District 7, has now mandated masks in 2 of its counties. And there are certainly people who are not happy with that decision, but you didn't see anywhere near the level of disruption that you've seen in public health districts 1 and 3. So it's been the response. There are people who are unhappy with the idea of mandates all over the state, to be clear, but the way that the Board of Health officials are looking at the data is different in every single district. And Eastern Idaho, I have to point out, has a really impressive plan, to be honest. They have clear metrics, what they look at county by county in their district, and it's predictable. It's public. You know the metrics they're looking at. And if one county hits those metrics, you know what to expect.
James Dawson is here from Boise State Public Radio News as well. Jimmy, these health districts are in this position because the governor has basically said he doesn't want to order any further state level directives. And the governor continued to get pushback on this, including yesterday during a press event you covered.
Yeah, that's right. And we should say that his position on kind of relinquishing control to the different public health districts was kind of an evolution after significant pushback from within his own party. Right. I mean, if you listen to the first press conference he had when he announced the stay-at-home order, he said that, I could potentially issue several orders and several restrictions. We could move back through phases when he did reopen. But then after Speaker of the House Scott Bedke sent him a letter saying, I can't guarantee we're not going to take a look at your administrative power next year when the legislature reconvenes, and tons of other legislators pushing back, including, although she's not a legislator, but second in command, Lieutenant Governor Janice McGeehan, kind of openly defying it. Then he was like, okay, well, I guess I'll hand over some power to the local public health districts. As for yesterday, we're still in stage four across the rest of Idaho, aside from Ada County, which is in a modified stage three. The numbers aren't great. If you look at the packet from Southwest District Health yesterday that was not discussed, but it was in the packet, for example, across all St. Al's locations, positive test rates went from 3.4% to 20% in a month. This week at their Nampa Hospital, 58 inpatients were admitted and 9 in the ICU, which is half their capacity. And it's even worse at St. Luke's. ICUs in Nampa and Meridian for them were full on Tuesday morning. Monday, they reached an all-time high of 100 hospitalizations for COVID-19. And predictive models for both health systems show that these numbers are going to double every 2 weeks, because changes, they really don't expect any changes to be made in community behavior, like wearing masks. So it's kind of a wait and see approach with every 2 weeks exponentially doubling.
Yeah, Aaron, and I want to wrap this part of the conversation up with you in Canyon County because of some of those numbers that Jimmy was just laying out. What feels like it's next in the Southwest District, specifically in Canyon County, as you know, ICU beds start to run short and those critical patients are then transferred across health district lines, I might add, into Ada County. Does it feel like this is going to come to a head again, or is it just we hope everybody complies?
That's a really good point. And actually, a St. Luke's official during the Southwest District Health meeting noted to the Idaho Press that she believes that Canyon County is actually worse off than Ada County right now, even though Ada County has higher numbers overall. When you consider the population, Ada County is almost more than double, I believe, than Canyon County. And the new case rates between both counties are pretty close, even though Ada County is still slightly ahead. And so the Southwest District Health Board chairman said at the meeting that he was at that time still probably going to vote against any mandates that came before him if nothing changed. And I think a big piece of that was that he didn't feel that there would be adequate ways to enforce such a mandate based on kind of where the public stood on that. And so it's going to be really telling in the coming weeks as how the effect of Ada County's mask mandate has an effect on the overall numbers. And I, this is speculation at this point, but I wouldn't be surprised to see Canyon County overtake Ada County in the fastest number of growing cases.
We are continuing our reporter roundtable. Our guests, Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television, Jimmy Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News, and Aaron Bamer, the Nampa Caldwell reporter for the Idaho Press. Thanks for being here today. A significant number of Idaho's COVID-19 cases and deaths have been in long-term care facilities. The state releases that data weekly each Friday afternoon. As of last Friday, there are significant outbreaks at multiple facilities in the Treasure Valley, few of which are equipped to properly care for COVID-19 patients. Aaron, you reported this week Nampa officials and one such facility in Boise are working together to try to find a solution to this.
Yes, you summarized that. That long-term care residents are very vulnerable population to COVID-19. And we've seen, Nampa officials specifically were seeing that not very many facilities around the Treasure Valley were well equipped to care for patients with COVID-19 in a way that, you know, kept them isolated from other residents and kept themselves and staff safe. And so as a result, 9 long-term care residents from Nampa were actually transported to a facility in Twin Falls, which is now at full capacity, so it can't take any more patients. And so Nampa officials, in collaboration with Southwest District Health, other health officials, and long-term care facilities figured out a way to kind of accommodate patients here. A facility in Boise, Arbor Valley of Cascadia, opened a wing last week that can hold up to 70 patients specifically for COVID-19 to treat them. And they opened last week, and I checked in with the director of that facility earlier this week, and it sounds like they've already admitted 7 patients and are working on an additional 2.
Just briefly, do you get the sense that there are enough trained caretakers willing to step up and work in this environment to provide the level of care necessary for both people who need, you know, regular types of long-term care within the environment of now being diagnosed with COVID-19?
Yeah, it seems like the willingness to help is there, but obviously healthcare officials, like medical professionals, are also posing a big risk to themselves. I mean, we just saw last week, I believe that was when the nurse practitioner with St. Luke's passed mm-hmm. away, 45 years old. So they're posing a big risk to themselves, but every medical professional that I've spoken to personally doesn't seem really to be concerned over their own health that much at all, but they're mostly just invested in helping others, which is really remarkable, in my opinion. The director of the Cascadia facility in Boise said that they're making sure to keep all staff that work within this COVID-19 wing of the facility specifically working in this wing and not working with other patients. So they're very, very much aware of the risks involved in spreading this disease.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's pivot to the State House now. Of course, out of session, but various committees are meeting. County clerks across the state have asked for a special session, so lawmakers can set the ground rules for the upcoming election. Jimmy, are you hearing that a special session might be doable this September?
Yeah, I mean, it's still unclear right now. I spoke with the governor's press secretary, Marissa Morrison Heyer, earlier today, and she basically said that, you know, discussions about a lot of things are going on between House and Senate leadership and the governor's office, including a special session. You know, lawmakers, particularly a smaller subset of them, have been wanting a special session and been calling for one for months, whether to address the state's coronavirus response, how it spends federal dollars that were awarded to Idaho through the CARES Act, or a whole number of other things. At this point, we don't know if there's going to be one, but the mm-hmm. county clerks say that they need one in order to enact a few laws. Kind of at the top of their list would be, it's kind of procedural, but basically delaying the day by which they would have to send out absentee ballots, which would be, under their proposal, 30 days before the election itself, as opposed to 45 days like it is right now. Apparently, that would lighten the workload for them. That's something that they want. They also want to potentially at least give counties and county clerks the ability to consolidate precincts and polling places into larger voting centers, mostly because they say that some of their precincts, particularly in Ada County, are smaller. They don't really allow for social distancing and might not be the best facilities for any in-person voting. There's no real push that I've heard from the Secretary of State's office to do another all vote by mail, all absentee ballot election for the general election. Mm-hmm. But I don't know what kind of appetite there would be for in-person voting, since absentee ballot requests are still through the roof.
So that's one thing, maybe one of the more pressing things happening adjacent to the State House right now. Melissa, you've been following some of this out of session committee work. What else are lawmakers working on right now?
Well, there are 4 working groups, and on Monday, the State Affairs one met to address those election concerns from county clerks. But we also have education concerns. There are also budgetary concerns with how much money Idaho has received from the federal government and how that should be doled out. There are also limited liability concerns that the Judiciary Committee will take up. I interviewed Senate President Pro Tem Brent Hill earlier today about what his priorities are and would be if they were to call a special session. And at the top of the list, in addition to the county clerk's concerns, is education spending. As far as how money from the CARES Act should be doled out and spent by school districts. And that, of course, is a huge concern. We are going to be starting a lot of public schools here in about 3 weeks.
Right.
And that's absolutely on a lot of people's mind. And so, you know, will they actually call a special session? That's yet to be determined. But I think if I were to put money on anything, I think it would be over the county clerk's concerns on being able to handle. Because as Jimmy said, the amount of pressure that the county clerks and their elections workers had to deal with the pivot, the hard pivot to mail-in voting, was extremely stressful. They had one county clerk who had served in her position since 2003 quit. They've had a number of poll workers who have expressed very serious concerns about working the general election. Mm-hmm. And they brought up a number of issues that they cannot handle the volume in a speedy and cost efficient way the way it's set up now.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember reading. Oh, go. Sorry. Go ahead, Jimmy.
Something that I forgot to mention that Melissa touched on was that another one of their highest priorities was right now they cannot count those absentee ballots until. I believe they can start on Monday, the day before the election, and all they can do is basically open it and put it in a pile and maybe scan it. Another one of their proposals would allow them to do that a week ahead of time with, you know, Ada County Clerk Phil McGrain saying basically like, well, we could give you the election results the night of election night if we're allowed to count them a little bit earlier, or you might see them several days often in the future if not.
And just specific to that counting thing, the Idaho County Free Press reported after the previous election that, you know, that county was the last in the state to hand count ballots, and they struggled. They had to call in reserves from the county courts to make sure they could get everything done that night, and they have now asked to purchase electronic machines. So this is an issue. It's moving counties forward in some places, perhaps, but absolutely an issue. Melissa, you had mentioned the state legislature's planning to dole out CARES Act relief funding. And Aaron, you had a story in the Idaho Press this week. The city of Nampa is working on ways to spend more than $3 million of these dollars, use it or lose it funding by the end of the year. What are they shaping up to spend that money on, Aaron?
Yes, so the city of Nampa was allocated $3.3 million from the CARES Act to use on COVID-19 related expenses that they can use from now up until December 30th. The finance director presented a proposal to use about $1.2 million of that funding in the current budget year, which ends on September 30th, to use for a couple of different uses, including updating the city's audio system for clearer meetings, changing the city's chairs to be more, you know, COVID compliant, updating the city's phone system, getting better new cleaning supplies, and covering unemployment costs. And so the city council has not approved that yet. That's going to come forward as a budget amendment in a future meeting. But that still obviously leaves a big chunk of over $2 million left that the city will not be able to access if they don't use it before December 30th. And so that's still up in the air, how the city chooses to use that funding. The finance director said that if there is a need that arises within the the coming months or the 3 months that are separated out in the next fiscal year before December 30th, that would allow them to use the funding. He would come forward for another budget amendment, but as of right now, they don't have any plans that I'm aware of how to use that remaining $2 million or so of CARES Act funds.
The legality of two bills passed last legislative session is in question. The transgender birth certificate bill and transgender athlete ban bill were both argued in federal court this week. Jimmy, what are lawyers for the two sides saying in this case?
Well, I guess let's start with the birth certificate one, just because it's, I guess there are fewer moving parts with this one. This is actually still a continuation of a case from 2017 where Lambda Legal, which is an LGBTQ advocacy legal group, sued the state because of a policy at the time that just categorically banned transgender people from changing the sex on their birth certificates. They won that, and in 2018, the state had to comply with that. Well, you had this new law that passed just earlier this year that would essentially do the same thing. There are some instances where people could change their birth certificates, but not transgender people. And so basically the Lambda Legal side is trying to get Judge Candy Dale, a federal district court judge here in Idaho, to say that her permanent injunction does apply to this new law, arguing that it's still a categorical ban. So I guess it was Wednesday, both of them were argued the same day. And the state is saying, no, look, this isn't a categorical ban because some people can change the sex on their birth certificates after 1 year. But the example that they gave was someone who had previously changed the gender marker and now wants to, in this hypothetical situation, change it back to the sex that was assigned to them at birth, which by definition means that they're not a transgender person and therefore would not apply to transgender people. And so Judge Candy Dale had said that she had intended to rule from the bench during this hearing, but she was taking all of these arguments under advisement and would get out some kind of order soon on that. The state also, by the way, argued that they should not, have this permanent injunction applied to this new law because they would need a new case and new facts to consider before declaring it unconstitutional. As for the transgender athlete bill, like I said, lots of moving parts. You've got the special interest group called Alliance Defending Freedom, which helped push the bill at the state house this year. They want to intervene in this case and represent two runners at Idaho State University who say that they feel it would be unfair to compete with and against transgender women. The state wants the overall lawsuit dismissed, but the legal groups who brought it, like the ACLU, want this law blocked. Something that was kind of surprising from the state side is that they were arguing that basically one of the components of this law would be any athlete, any woman athlete in particular, could be challenged at any time by a parent, by maybe one of the school administrators or a fellow student, and be accused of being transgender. And then they would have to basically sit out and sit on the sidelines until they could verify their gender, which earlier iterations of this bill had what opponents called a pretty invasive exam. The law as it's written now says that a healthcare provider basically can just attest to this. And that's what the state was arguing was, you know, you don't have to undergo a physical exam. You don't have to undergo genetic testing or something else, which the ACLU kind of said they were caught off guard on, and said that, okay, well, if that's actually the case, you know, their plaintiff, Lindsay Hecox, who is a Boise State University student who hopes to run cross country next year for them, or I guess this year, if that's still going on, she could get a note from her doctor saying, yes, Lindsay is a woman and should be eligible for this, but they want a court order saying that that is actually the case, because that certainly did not seem like the legislative intent and certainly was not something that I ever heard from any lawmaker who was supporting this bill earlier this year.
And, Jimmy, Go ahead.
I was going to say, and I should say that Judge David Nye is taking all of this under advisement, but hopes to at least rule on whether or not the law can be temporarily blocked by August 10th.
Okay, and that was actually my follow-up question, kind of the what's next, and any indication of when Judge Dale might rule on the birth certificate if she didn't rule from the bench?
No, she said, I don't make a habit of saying soon, but I guess I just did. So we have no timeline, and she's under no obligation to give anyone a timeline or meet any kind of deadline.
Okay. Thanks for that, Jimmy. All right. So I want to shift now to the opening of schools. With us on our reporter roundtable today, Melissa Davlin from Idaho Public Television. You just heard Jimmy Dawson from Boise State Public Radio News. And we have Aaron Bamer with us from the Idaho Press as well. High School Activities Association says fall sports are starting up August 10th, and that's good to go for many districts. August 17th is the first day of school in many places across the state. Maybe. And just this morning, the New York Times reported that the CDC has now walked back its previous cautious guidance, which the president last week called very tough and expensive. And the paper says the CDC has now issued a full-throated call to reopen schools and is offering a package of tools and resources to make that happen. Melissa, the ground is moving underneath administrators, parents, students, teachers. Is there any district you're aware of in the state that has any type of firm reopening plan right now?
I would say look to the districts where there is little to no coronavirus spread right now. Mm-hmm. They have a pretty good idea of how things are going coming up here in the next 3 or 4 weeks. The same is not true for Idaho's most populated cities. And I'm looking at this as both a reporter and a mother who needs to make decisions about my own child and what we're going to be doing with him. It, like you said, the ground is constantly shifting underneath us, and it is difficult for administrators. It's certainly difficult for staff and teachers, who many of whom are older, especially in rural areas. Idaho's rural teachers trend older, and many of them are in that high risk category. So, and we haven't even talked about the kids and safety yet. Yesterday, Idaho Department of Health and Welfare released a new data set that showed that 14 children in Idaho have been hospitalized statewide so far because of COVID-19. This is not just an issue for adults. And so we know that Caldwell is pushing back their in-person instruction. Boise School District is going to delay their decision until a special meeting on August 3rd, and we'll keep an eye on cases. And in the meantime, there are a lot of parents who are trying to decide, without having all the information in front of them, whether they should go with online school or in-person school. We don't know how many kids are going to be in online school. We don't know how many kids are going to be in the classroom having to socially distance from each other. There's so much to follow. And as a parent, it's overwhelming. It is absolutely overwhelming. And I'm in a two-parent household, right? For my friends who are single mothers, it's even more difficult.
Aaron, as you cover Nampa and Caldwell, and Nampa's a one-to-one district, which I know from talking to educators there, that made a difference as they had to quickly pivot to at-home learning. And that means every kid has a device that they can use. What are you hearing that the district of Nampa is ramping up to do this fall?
Yeah, the district has not made a final decision, as far as I'm aware, on whether they're going to reopen their schools or not. They should be making a decision soon, though. Obviously, the governor has come out and said that he wants schools to reopen. But from what I'm hearing from educators, they're still very split on what they think the best option is. Some mm-hmm. are saying that with the way Idaho's cases are going, and particularly in Canyon County, if nothing changes, it will not be safe for students and school staff to resume work within school buildings. And others have said that the remote learning model is not sustainable for teachers, that it requires a lot more preparation than regular teaching does. They're working long hours from morning until late at night, and they can't imagine continuing to do so for an entire school year or for however long this pandemic continues to last. And that's notable coming from NAMPA teachers that are specifically saying that, because NAMPA School District is a one-to-one device district and was one of the few districts that was really well prepared when this all hit in Idaho to transition right to remote learning.
Melissa, real quick, in the minute we have left, the school issue is one thing. The childcare aspect of this is a completely different one, because if you have people keeping their kids home with jobs, I'm in that boat. How do you make sure that kids are taken care of, are educated, and people that can't work from home finding childcare? This is a whole nother side to this.
It's a whole other side to it. You not only have the safety of childcare facilities, but you also have a lot of childcare businesses that are shutting down right now because right. they have more people pulling their kids out of schools. We have a whole interview about it tonight on Idaho Reports, airing 8 p.m. on Idaho Public Television. It's a fantastic conversation. But I will say that the keeping kids at home, whether it's online learning or because you can't find childcare, is something that disproportionately affects women. That's another thing we explore in today's show. And with childcare businesses shutting down and operating at limited capacity, that's most of these business owners are women. And that's another thing that disproportionately affects us as well.
All right. We've been speaking with Melissa Davlin with Idaho Public Television. Watch that conversation tonight. Jimmy Dawson with Boise State Public Radio News and Aaron Bamer from the Idaho Press. Thanks so much. I'm Troy Opper.
Thank you.
You're listening to Idaho Matters.